Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah! Will take place May 13th to the 15th, 2016 at the Doubletree Inn in Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming in New England at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information. Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 151, Henry Hyde's Shot, Steel, and Stone Wargaming Rules. So if you are a new listener, or even if you're a longtime listener, you can probably tell by the name of this episode that we have a very special guest. And if you've been listening a long time, I hope you've heard him in previous episodes, and if you're new to the show, you are in for a treat. But before we go any further, I just want to make sure that, you know, we're probably going to cover all sorts of stuff in this episode, and it's hard to remember it all. You're probably commuting to work, or maybe you're painting. You don't have to remember everything we discuss, because I put it in the show notes, which you can get at by going online and visiting wargamingrecon.com/WR151. That's wargamingrecon.com/WR151. So with that little bit out of the way, I want to welcome our very special guest, the one, the only, Mr. Henry Hyde. Henry, how are you today?
I'm fine, Jonathan. Thanks very much for having me on the show. It's been a long time.
Too long. You are someone I could have on every episode because it is always so informative and enjoyable. And people just, I get written to all the time because people love when you're on and they want to know when you're going to be on again.
Wow. All those misguided people, goodness me. Haven't they got something better to do with their lives, Jonathan?
Didn't you know you had a fan club?
Well, it's a lovely thought. It's a lovely thought. If only that could be translated into millions in the bank, that would be fantastic.
I would love for you to make your riches off it. I'm sure a lot of listeners know you, of course, from Miniature War Games and Battle Games Magazine. But one of my favorite things you've ever done is the Wargaming Compendium. This is, I think, perhaps one of the most important wargaming books of my time. And so I know people buy it because I look at, I have a link so people can purchase it on Amazon, and tons and tons and tons of people click on that link, and I know people are purchasing it. So people must be loving it, and I know it gets talked about all the time, but this is just the beginning for you, isn't it?
Crikey. Yes, I suppose. It is. It seems extraordinary to talk about something that was just a beginning when it took me 4 years to create, and is what, 520 pages and weighs 2.5 kilos. And to a certain extent, there's part of me that thinks, oh, surely Henry, that's enough. Can't you just stop there? That'll do. Just the one. Be a one hit wonder. Be a one hit wonder. You know, it's really nice. I mean, what you said is really nice, Jonathan. It's very kind of you. And it is supported by, you know, some evidence that other people do contact me and ask, you know, what are you working on now, Henry? When's the next thing coming out? I mean, obviously there's some other people who are out there who say, God, I never want to hear another word from this man. He's everywhere. Can't we shut him up?
I don't know any of those people.
Well, you're lucky, Jonathan. From time to time I meet them. But anyway, the main thing is, however, that the publishing company, Pen and Sword, want me to continue doing stuff. And I currently have contracts for, it's definitely 3 and probably 4 new books. And I thought I knew which order they were going to come out in. What had been agreed with Pen and Sword after the Wargaming Compendium, we'd had a discussion with Phil Sidnor, who's my editor with Pen and Sword, and we'd discussed the next book in the series being one about wargaming campaigns. So that's kind of what I've been working towards. But also at the same time, as you've kind of picked up on there, much to my surprise, and I mean this genuinely, this isn't kind of disingenuous, it turns out that people out there have actually been using the Shot, Steel, and Stone rules that are in the Wargaming Compendium, which is fantastic. I mean, I knew they'd been fairly thoroughly playtested because as I think we might have discussed before, kind of on alternate years, I help organise a big wargaming get-together in a place called Ayton up in Yorkshire near Scarborough. We play these huge imaginations, kind of 18th century games based on my own mad world, as has been described previously in, you know, Battle Games magazine and partly in the book, the Wars of the Faltinian Succession. And what's happened is that, a bunch of guys who, to be honest, I'd never met in the flesh. We met online through various forums, and there's one particular forum where a lot of these guys hang out, and they're all over the UK, but they've kind of taken this idea of imaginations, you know, fictitious countries to heart. And so it was really gratifying that they kind of read the book and seen what I was writing in the magazine. And many of them contacted me and said, well, Henry, you know, could I participate in this kind of world you created? Well, that's fantastic, you know, and these people have invested their own hard-earned cash and money and time, particularly as you're getting older, the most important thing is time, in recruiting and collecting and painting and basing, their own imaginations. And that's amazing to me. And God, you know, that people actually want to take part in this universe that I've built. It's slightly different. I think if you're someone like Rick Priestley, for example, who creates a universe for a commercial product, like, you know, the Warhammer universe, something like that, you're pretty much hoping that people are going to buy into that, right? Because you've got entire factories and figure ranges kind of dependent on people buying into that. But to me, this was just something I loved doing. I'd started off doing solo. My old university chum guy Hancock got involved with it years ago. Then that kind of fallen away. I'd done some more solo. And then it was only since the birth of, you know, the internet really, and then the growth of the old school wargaming group, that I started writing about this again and people got interested. So to a certain extent, those Shotstein and Stone rules fulfilled two purposes. The first was, I kind of felt that if I'm writing a book called The Wargaming Compendium, there really ought to be a set of rules in there of some kind. Because I think I'd feel cheated if I bought a book claiming to be a compendium of all things wargaming, and I didn't include at least one set of rules in there. I mean, as you know, actually, I think there's three, isn't there? Because there's the gladiator rules in there, there's the Wild West skirmish rules, and the Shotstein and Stone rules. In fact, if you include the campaign rules, there's four rule sets, really. But anyway, so the kind of objective number one was to include a set of rules in the book, just to feel like I was doing my job properly. But at the same time, I realized, well, I could kill two birds with one stone here. I could write a set of rules for the book. This actually, but it also gives me the opportunity to write the set of rules that I've always wanted to use for Horse and Musket era wargaming myself. Because as you know, I'm not near that particular bookshelf at the moment, but there are any number, dozens, hundreds probably of different rule sets that have been written to cover wargaming in the Horse and Musket era. But like all wargamers, I'm a tinkerer, and you often feel like, oh yes, well, I really like Black Powder, for example, as a set of wargames rules, but oh, I just wish that the rules for heavy cavalry were slightly different, or that the rules for morale were slightly different. You know, we all do this. But there's always, you know, that's a really nice set of rules. I don't mind spending nowadays it would probably be here in the UK, £20-30 on it, you know, because it comes in a nice book and there's pretty pictures. But as a rule set for me, well, you know, I think when we're down the club, I'll just, you know, tinker with it a bit. We're inveterate tinkers. So this was my opportunity to do some tinkering and look at all the rule sets that were out there and other ideas I'd have myself and kind of bolt together, you know, like going into a goodies shop where you can mix and match all the sweets that you want. And so, oh, I'll have some of those and some of these toffees here and some of those caramels and some of this licorice stuff. Put it all in a bag and there's your ideal licorice selection, if you like. So that's the other purpose it fulfilled. having done that, of course, is you think, well, it looks okay to me. Oh my God, does it actually work? You know, panic. And fortunately, big sigh of relief, it turns out they work because the guys who, we get together for these big games at 18, you know, when you've got like 12 or 14 or 16 guys around a table who are all highly competitive, if your rule set doesn't work, they're going to find out pretty damn quick, right? Huge sigh of relief that it seemed to work, you know, and everyone seemed happy with it and everyone had fun. There was lots of laughter around the table even, you know, oh, that's a good sign. People are really enjoying the game and not worrying too much about the rules. And I think as a rules writer, that's almost as much as you can ever hope for, isn't it? That, you know, I don't want people to necessarily think, oh yes, this is by far the most accurate set of 18th century rules that's ever been written. Because how would you really define that, you know? Because I've played a lot of rules in the past that I'm sure some people would say they're very accurate, but oh my God, they've been so boring and there's endless tables of pluses and minuses and you've got to do this and then do that and oh, on and on and on it goes. And you kind of forget that there's supposed to be a game in there somewhere. So the fact that people are actually using the rules, having fun, laughing about it, that was a huge relief. I mean, obviously, amongst this group of guys, and they've now played with the rules at these big games, it's probably about 4 years. This will be, I think, the fifth time we'll have used them. They have different interpretations, and there are some people who, you know, might have a should we say they really like using artillery, so they want to have really powerful artillery and they kind of wish I'd made artillery more powerful than it is in my rules. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, I kind of know what I'm talking about, right? I can, you know, we're sitting here at the bookshelf. Let me reach behind Jonathan and I can pull off my shelf. I don't know. Let's have a look at, here's a typical one, you know, Christopher Duffy, you know, the Army of Frederick the Great and lots of other books up there. W. Chandler. Now, I've done my reading. I wasn't there at the time, you know, I'm not several hundred years old. I wasn't actually sitting there on the ranges while they were testing Frederick the Great's artillery in the 18th century. But, you know, I think I know as much as anyone can about most of what went on during that period. But as I say, I didn't want that kind of almost dry academic stuff to get in the way. So, and at the end of the day, it's a game, right? We're supposed to be having fun. But what the decisions I made in terms of how powerful I've made artillery versus cavalry versus infantry and so on and so forth, I've tried to make the best possible judgment calls as I can to create an enjoyable game that will produce reasonably realistic outcomes. And I think that's kind of as much as you can hope for. Kind of going back to the beginning of the question, you know, there's the shot, steel and stone rules have, it turns out, taken on a bit of a life of their own. And I discovered that there were people outside this immediate group that I've been gaming with who said, oh yes, I use your rules, not all the time, but you know, from time to time. And then in particular, there's one guy who's over on your side of the Atlantic, Jonathan, guy called Jay Arnold and his brother, Chris. And they've been, it turns out, using my rules. I'm not sure where Jay lives. I should have checked. Illinois. I think he's up in Illinois somewhere. And they've been using my rules. And he started emailing me with questions. And it's like, wow, I wasn't expecting that. People actually interested in enough in the rules to ask me questions, to have me explain things about the rules, the period, and so on and so forth. And then some other people kind of turned up, and I realized, oh gosh, all right, there's actually people out there interested in the rule set as a standalone thing. Now, Pen and Sword, the publishers, had already kind of said to me, oh, you know, at some point in the future, it might be quite nice to do these. And, you know, we want to make sure that you don't publish them with anyone else. So here's a contract, Henry. So I'd already signed a contract. So this is contract number two. So there was the Wargaming Campaigns book, which I'm supposed to be working on right now. And there's the Shot, Steel and Stone Horse and Musket Rules. And so this was kind of like, well, this is interesting because the amount of interest being generated by the shot, seeing and stone rules is starting to kind of almost overbalance the amount of interest in Henry High doing a Wargaming Campaigns book, which we can come back to. So it's like, oh, well, it was supposed to be Wargaming Campaigns this year, 2016, Shot, Steel and Stone 2017, and then another thing I'll come on to later. But it may well be that the Shot, Steel and Stone rules come out before the Wargaming Campaigns book. Not sure yet. Obviously need to talk to the publishers. This is fairly important. We'll see. But that's kind of interesting. So that spawned, as it happened, might have seen in here we go, I'll flash a copy, Miniature War Games magazine, not this issue, but the previous one, I explained how to set up a Facebook page. And I was scratching my head, you know, because I do this column about the World Wide Web, what could I use as an example? And I thought, well, okay, I'll set up a Facebook page about my Shot, Steel and Stone rules. So I went through it step by step and set up this page, and some people came along immediately, blimey, and said, oh yes, we like Shot, Steel and Stone. And then I started trying to do things to interact with the people visiting that Facebook page. And I suddenly realized, do you know what? I've done the wrong thing here. What this really needs is a Facebook group, not a Facebook page. Facebook page is great if you just want to kind of broadcast stuff to an audience. You know, if the Shot, Steel and Stone rules book came out and I wanted to advertise to the world, hey, there's this new set of rules you can come and buy and here's some stuff about it and some nice videos and people come along and like that and make some comments, that's great. But if you actually want to engage with an audience in discussions, then I realize, oh, I think I actually need a group. And the reason that also kind of propelled me towards setting up a Facebook group as well is I wanted to make it clear that I genuinely want people's input. You know, if people, you can never 100% playtest a set of rules. And there might be people in Latvia or Mongolia or Ethiopia, I have no idea where, who are, you know, sitting next to a war games table somewhere in the middle of the desert, scratching their heads thinking, oh, what did he mean by this? I don't understand what he means by this. And a group is really good because then they can just join the group, come along and say, Henry, what did you mean by this rule here? And because it's one of those things, when you write something like a rule sort or any technical document, obviously you hope you've written it in such a way that anyone could pick that document up, read it and understand it. But of course there's always going to be someone out there, and sometimes you think they're doing it deliberately, but let's not go there. Someone out there who just doesn't seem to understand what to you seemed completely obvious. So, you know, for example, when you talk about a formation change, this is typical in, of course, a musket era rule set, isn't it? Someone talks about, changing face, you know. To you, I know exactly what changing face means. You know, it means my men are changing to face in a different direction. But they're thinking, what do you mean changing face? Is it literally something to do with they're putting a mask on? What's going on there? I don't understand. So this is why having a group where you can interact with your readers is fantastic. And so I set up this little Facebook group and said to the people who had already visited the page, look, if you're interested in helping me to play test and develop this rule set in ways that I'll mention in a minute, come and join the group, because there all opinions are valid and equal, and I'm genuinely interested in where have people had difficulty with the rules, where are you pushing the boundaries, you know, because I've seen this rule set as being kind of 1685 to 1845, that kind of period. Maybe people playing, you know, in the early part of that period are thinking, oh, I'm not sure that this works properly. Perhaps we need to adapt it slightly in this way. Or people towards the end of the period are thinking, oh, we need to adapt. Or people are just playing games with the rules and something unexpected comes up. You know, you never expected your Landwehr militia lancers to rout those guard cuirassiers. Did we read something wrong here, Henry, you know? Or is it just that they were incredibly lucky? So that's why I set up the group. So there's been, I don't know, it's coming up nearly 20 people have joined this as a closed group, because I don't want to publicly broadcast everything we're discussing. But for trusted people, such as yourself, Jonathan, you know, who've come along and are willing to kind of make a contribution to the group. This is the thing, you don't, with a Facebook group, you want people who are actually going to kind of participate, you know, not just sit there on the wall taking notes and going, that's very interesting. You want people who are going to take what you say, go out and play with it, and then come back and say, hey, well, I tried that idea. It worked like this. The other thing is that already in my own head, even when the Wargaming Compendium was being published, and that's, crikey, that's 2.5 years ago now, John, that was 2013, July 2013. When it was being published, I was already thinking, you know what, obviously most of my gaming tends to be in the horse and musket era, but actually I really like the American Civil War, for example, and I'm quite interested in the later wars of the 19th century in Europe, and going earlier, well, the English Civil War, the 30 Years' War. So already we're kind of pushing it back towards, say, 1600. And then if you're pushing it that far, well, there's the Elizabethans, weren't that much different. So that's the 1580s and then French Wars of Religion. Okay, 1560s, 30s, you know. And at the other end, well, there is that major shift, isn't there? Kind of round about the year 1900 or thereabouts, in 18, sort of the time of the Boer War, where I kind of feel like, I think after that, warfare has become so mechanized in a sense that you really need to approach the rules quite differently. I couldn't imagine using the basic mechanisms of my shot, steel and stone rules for, you know, even the Boer War would really be pushing it. And a number of the other colonial wars, certainly, you know, not First World War, Second World War, forget it. Going back the other way, however, there's a secret. Which I don't know if I've told you, which is when I was first contemplating this, a rule set for the Wargaming Compendium, it was actually going to be a set of Ancients rules. Did you know that?
No, I did not. That actually intrigues me because I don't necessarily equate you with ancient wargaming.
Well, yeah, that's largely because for quite a long time I haven't done very much. I haven't done as much, anywhere near as much as I would like. But when I was a youngster, I did a load of ancient wargaming. You know, I went around the school wargames club. Now, this was back in the, oh my God, so this would be the late 1970s, when the wargames research group rules were all the rage. And back then, it was probably the 5th and 6th editions of the WRG Ancients rule. Everything went screwy. They changed everything with the 7th edition, so that was very different. But certainly, for a good... oh gosh, from about the age of 12 through to 18, so about 6 years of my youth, I did masses of Ancients gaming. I did as much Ancients gaming as I did anything else, right? And it's remained a passion of mine. I love ancient history. I've always been intrigued by ancient history. When I was at university, in fact, I did a course, because I studied history at university. One of the courses I did was on the Greek city-state and the Greek and Persian wars and the Peloponnesian war, all that kind of stuff. Excuse me. So classical ancient is kind of in my blood. I'm also interested in, obviously, the Romans and the Gauls and, you know, all that sort of stuff. There are certain ancient armies that I never actually collected myself. I wish I had, like the Sassanid Persians with all their cataphracts, heavily armored cataphracts and stuff. I love that kind of stuff. So when I was kind of first thinking of doing a rule set for the book, it started as an ancients rule set. And I did a number of playtests with Philip Sidnell, who is my editor at Pen and Sword, as I mentioned. He himself is an established writer of ancient history. In fact, if I look at my up here, no, it's not there. Damn. I thought it was there. He wrote a really good book called The Ancient War Horse, which is all about the development of different horse breeds used by ancient cavalry and so on and so forth. Fascinating stuff. So he came here two or three times and helped me playtest early versions of the rule set as an Ancients rule set. The thing is, you know, anyone who's played any ancient rules, ancient war games knows Ancients are surprisingly complicated. You think it's just, you know, sword and sandal and bash, bash, bash. It's really simple. That's not. Because you've got so many different combinations of weapons and armor and shields and all that kind of stuff. Ranged weapon fire, you know, you've got archery, but javelins and darts and goodness knows what and slingshots and what are the effects of all these weapons on armor? And, you know, you've got leather armor, you've got bronze armor, you've got scale armor, you've got, it goes on and on and on. So what it means is that you need to do a lot of playtesting. You know, everything from up in one corner, ancient Britons, down to in the other corner, you know, you got the ancient Egyptians, and they might be nearly 4,000 years apart, right? And 4,000 miles apart. There's just so many different permutations that you need to make sure that you get the playtesting right and you're convinced that you get good, authentic, convincing games in pretty much every outcome. So we just realized that if I carried on writing this Ancients rule set, that was going to take me a long, long time to get right. And it was starting already to become a priority that I got the damn book written. So we had a long chat and a think, and I realized that there were some of the basic core mechanisms that I created for this rule set that could be applied to most periods of history. And so I thought, right, okay, the simplest thing is, how about I go back to the period of history that I am best known for and I've got lots of stuff for, and, you know I can make it work. And essentially that's why I went for horse and musket. Because, you know, infantry, cavalry, artillery is a bit like paper, scissors, stone. So that was kind of an obvious decision, really. But yeah, the first rule set that I was going to include in the book was an Ancients rule set. So that gives a clue as well, because what that means is, quite obviously, there is, on a back burner somewhere, simmering away in the corner, there's a set of Ancients rules that I just need to finish writing. But I think that the first thing I need to do is to take the horse and musket shots in stone rules and develop those in meaningful ways to cover certainly things like the American Civil War, things like the Austro-Prussian and Franco-Prussian War in Europe, and then go back the other way, the English Civil War and the 30 Years' War. And I know that some of the people who've joined this Facebook group are interested in helping me do that. And in fact, we've discovered, because of these imaginations games, like there's a chat this year, we're doing another big game in May. It's going to be another sort of European 18th century type imaginations game, which will climax in a massive battle. But he's really difficult, this guy. Hello, Paul, if you're watching. I'm only kidding. He's not that difficult. He's a lovely bloke. But he lives in Scotland, and he's quite interested in raising a force that's very kind of Scottish in nature. And the Scots are famous, if nothing else, for their use of weapons in the 18th century that at the time would have been considered even then fairly primitive, like pikes and claymores and, you know, targe shields, round shields and broadswords. So this is, you know, something he wants to have his army equipped with for this big imaginations game. So the question, of course, was, right then, Henry, so how does a base of pikemen fare against a base of musket armed troops, you know, musket and bayonet armed troops? So it actually only took about a 30-second head scratch, because I realized I already had a mechanism in the rules that said, well, if two such bases should come to grips in a melee, it's always the troops armed with the longest weapons that strike first. So in that case, it would be the pike base that would strike first, regardless of anything else, if it's against, you know, pretty much any other troops on the battlefield. How effective they would be would come down to troop quality and a number of other factors, but, you know, they'd get the hit first, simple as that. And having realized that, it made me think, well, crikey, that means that in my head, almost immediately, I've got a set of English Civil War rules. I just need to kind of make the musketry a bit less effective because it's slower matchlock musketry as opposed to flintlock musketry. But essentially, I've got the rules for pikes and I've got the rules for muskets, so that sorts the infantry then, doesn't it, really? Cavalry's a, you know, another interesting one because in the English Civil War you had what are called galloper cavalry trained in Sweden in the 30 Years' War who were starting to, you know, draw swords and charge straight at the enemy again, whereas you still had some of the older kind of what would be called reiter-style cavalry armed with pistols who would trot up to the opposition, blam, point-blank range, and then trot to the rear rank again to reload. And they do this thing called a caracole, which is balmy to think of these days, but at the time that was considered a cutting-edge tactics, my God. So again, you know, looking at my rule set, well, I've got rules for cavalry charging straight in, that's just normal, and I've got rules for cavalry wanting to use their pistols, so there's no problem there either. So, you know, just describing in these few moments, it's not difficult to see how the rule set that I'd already got could be translated into a rule set that would also cover the English Civil War and so on and so forth. So this has kind of taken on a life of its own, and as you can probably tell, I'm quite excited about the possibilities of this. Excited enough to have gone out and bought, I've got a box here. It's got, can I show you? Let me wave some things in front of the, here we are. These, ladies and gentlemen, these are Pendragon 10mm English Civil War figures. There we go. So I've made a small investment. That's just one of the boxes. Because I'm also thinking that, well, looking at the space I haven't got left up here in the loft, I need to kind of downscale. And it's remarkable, actually. I ordered probably close to 1,000 figures from Pendragon, and they turned up in this little bag. And it's almost disappointing, you know, with 28mm figures, you're like, oh my God, how am I going to get that upstairs? But with Pendragon, or even more so, obviously back as 6mm, it turns up. And you think, really? Is the entire army's in there? And yes, it is. So playtesting will begin as soon as I can get a paintbrush near those figures. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now, Jonathan, because I've rabbited on for ages.
Well, I think you've managed to hit on, I'm going to call it like the golden pearl, where you've created something that has so excited people that they've then just taken it and run with it. And I think any sort of creator, I don't care what your medium is or what you're creating, that's what you hope for, whether it's intentional or otherwise, that just people are going to really get into what you're doing and then go with it. And like for you, they've done it with your rules, and it's amazing. To a different degree, I've experienced it where a few years ago, a listener was just so excited by some of the fundraising I was doing for a charity that they went ahead on their own and they had a model and they painted it. They auctioned it on eBay and donated the money. And I never expected that, but when you get that sort of buy-in from your audience and from the community, it's beautiful because I think when you get these other people involved, they do interesting and exciting and also unexpected things with what you've created. You probably would never expect someone to do, you know, X, Y, or Z, and they take it and they think, well, let me look at it from that other angle that only they can bring to it. So then they take it and they say, well, what about this? And then they try, and then they keep on pushing that envelope so that your creation gets even better. Because of it. It gets all those trials and it hopefully survives through all of them. It's very...
I think you've hit on an interesting point there, and I think it's in our hobby, this is particularly true of rule sets, that other people kind of take ownership of them, if that makes sense. And one of the interesting things, you know, with Rick Priestley, hi Rick, if you're listening, and his Black Powder rule set concept, where there's obviously over the last few years, there've been a number of other supplements for different periods have appeared based on the initial Black Powder concept. And those supplements have been written by other people. And that's really interesting. I that would be I suppose that would be kind of weird for me. It may happen one day, but if someone actually, you know, rang me up and said, Henry, you know, I'd really like to write a supplement for, The War of Jenkins' Ear using shots in the sound. Okay. I suppose at the moment they still kind of feel like they're my baby. And so I feel like I need to take responsibility for them still. So if there's going to be supplements written, certainly around those core periods, I ought to be the one writing them, because I also, like with the 18th century rules and the ancient rules, it's partly because, yeah, a big motivation for me is the English Civil War, for example, I hadn't played an English Civil War war game since I was at school until, I suppose it's about 3 weeks ago now. I got together with a good chum. I can't say too much about this. I have to be careful because it's still under wraps. I got together with a good chum and we played an English Civil War game using a rule set that this person's working on. And it was great fun. It was great fun. And the rules themselves, I definitely can't say too much about, but it was based on concepts I was familiar with. Completely unlike my own rules, but concepts I was familiar with. And it was really good fun, but it was also seeing all those units of, you know, blocks of pikes and muskets and cavalry trotting around and that kind of English Civil War scenery as well. I mean, it's very unique because you've got all these half-timbered buildings and lots of hedgerows and things like that. You know, English scenery is quite unique in a sense. You know, if you've ever been to the UK and you drive around, people love our country lanes because we have these little country lanes and hedgerows and little churches and stuff like that. And it was quite inspiring to me. You know, there's just occasionally you'll play a game and it'll really kind of get to you. You think, God, yeah, I want to do more of this. And it just so happens that this was at the same time as I'd been discussing with this guy, Paul Bright, about, you know, he wants to have these bloody Scottish pikemen in the middle of of our 18th century war games and stuff. And that kind of fired things off for me. And it very quickly resulted in an order to Pendragon and miniatures. That I am very much, oh, I think it and I do it. I really must kind of cut that connection somewhere. It's terrible. It's inspiring. And as you say, that when other people kind of invest in an idea that you've come up with, it's really exciting, because then it becomes this other thing, doesn't it? You know, there's that political theory, isn't it? Marxism is based on the theory of dialectics, where you have an argument, a counter argument, and then they produce this other thing, which then produces this other thing and another argument and so on. And it takes on a life of its own. And I'm sure that's how Rick Priestley feels about Black Powder. It's probably how he felt about 40K, you know, when he first wrote Warhammer 40K based on his Rogue Trader thing, all those years ago for Games Workshop. And then it became this monster commercial thing. I mean, that must have been very strange for him. I mean, I've interviewed him and spoken to him about this on a number of occasions, and I think he is to this day still kind of slightly bemused by how it just, you know, when you're talking about, you know, potentially millions of people doing something, is fine. I can handle it at the moment. It seems like, oh, there might be a few tens or a couple of hundred people around the world interested in playing my rules. I don't know what the actual number is, but there might be, you know, modest numbers of people interested in playing my rules. That's kind of, oh, that's nice. If it became tens or hundreds of thousands, it becomes something different, doesn't it? It's a bit like if you used to play the guitar in your bedroom and you put something on Spotify or YouTube and it goes viral. Man, that must really do your head in. It's kind of weird, the thought that there's all these zillions of faceless people around there kind of using your stuff. So, yeah, but that is, I completely agree, Jonathan. It's one of the nice things about, you know, publishing stuff. I mean, it's the same with the book. You know, Pen and Sword tell me that I don't know how many thousands of the book have now been sold. And that's, wow, that's amazing. And fortunately, not many people seem to have sent it back. Asked for a refund.
I think there's a really fine line between wanting to and actually attaining some level of success without getting to the point where you feel that it traps you. My wife is a big fan of Adele, and I'm a newcomer to enjoying Adele's music. She did an interview with James Corden on the Late Late Show, I think it was. She was saying that one of the reasons why it took so long for her new album to come out was with the massive success from her previous album, she felt like she could never do anything that would be as good, that she didn't want to let anyone down, and as such, she felt trapped by it, by her own success. It was preventing her from doing what she loves. And so it took a while for her to be able to work through that and get past it so that she could create something that she was proud of, that she felt was also true to what she's looking to do. And it seems to have resonated with people on a commercial basis and, you know, an emotional basis. But that's something I will never have to worry about that. But that's something that I often think about when, you know, I'm picking up a book or a magazine or whatever. And it's something that's being not promoted or supported by, say, like a gigantic entity, gigantic corporation. Yeah. I wonder how the success of it will impact the person who created it. And especially nowadays with Kickstarter, I see more and more Kickstarter projects that they are so successful that they literally kill the company that does it. They ruin the lives of the creators, and the whole thing comes crashing down where people either they're not prepared, or it's more than was ever expected. And how do you deal with that sudden windfall of it? And it has to be just emotionally difficult to kind of wrap your head around this and to think, okay, so now what? And you think, oh, it's going to be, you know, I hope someone will enjoy what I'm doing. Just one person. That's all I ask. And then it's thousands and thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. And all this money comes in, and it's like, okay, so what do I do now? And then it disappears.
Kickstarter is a really good example, because we've seen a number of spectacular successes and failures in the last few years, haven't we? And someone I know well, Will Townsend of the Plastic Soldier Company, who lives literally 10 miles down the road from me, and we get together quite often. They use Kickstarter to launch their version of Commands and Colors, their Great War version of Commands and Colors. And even though, you know, Plastic Soldier Company is a well-established company, they have staff, they have, you know, office premises, they're highly professional. When that Great War Kickstarter took off, it took them completely by surprise. Because the main thing that they underestimated was how much time they were going to have to spend managing people's expectations, right? He was telling me about, God, you know, I can't remember how many days it was after the Kickstarter had launched. They were getting asked so many questions about stuff that wasn't even in the original brief, right? And so why are people coming up with this stuff? It's got nothing to do with the project as advertised, right? Then loads of emails from people who, you know, they just weren't reading the bloody instructions, right? You know, they were expecting things that weren't being promised at all. Or they were asking questions about stuff that was already on the Kickstarter page. They just couldn't be bothered to scroll down, right? Literally, they couldn't be bothered to scroll down. Mind you, this is an internet phenomenon, isn't it? If someone new joins a forum, they start off by asking the classic newbie question that's been answered a thousand times before, but they just couldn't be asked to scroll back through the previous posts to see if anyone had asked that question before. So there's a collective virtual groan amongst the forums. Oh, God, I can't believe they just asked that. I can remember when I was involved heavily with the old school wargaming group, Yahoo group. When it started out, there was like, I don't know, a couple of hundred people, all of whom had read everything that Don Featherstone had ever written, Charles Grant had ever written, Charlie Wesencraft, or, you know, all these great doyens of the hobby. There was this, there was a couple of hundred of us who, and there was a high proportion of participation as well. You know, so there weren't many lurkers who were just sitting there as wallflowers. There were lots of people getting involved with discussions, excited about books that we'd all read, you know, in the early days of wargaming. And then it kind of, word got out about old school wargaming. It got really popular and suddenly it sort of shot up to like 1,000 members. And then this started where people would kind of almost come on and say, who was Don Featherstone? Who was Charles Grant? It's like, what? What? What are you doing here? What do you, read the sign above the door, you know, old school wargaming. You know, people who love the early books by Don Featherstone, Charles Grant, so on and so forth. And there were these people who were pretty much coming and saying, Don Featherstone, was he any good then? You know, did he write much? Yeah, right, 40 odd books, mate, right? And this is something you see in forums all the time, and it's something you're seeing on Kickstarter, because Kickstarter's, you know, a web-delivered kind of medium, and people are doing the same sort of things, or coming along, sort of asking dumb questions, where it's all in the instructions at the top, mate, right? Just, there's a thing in computer speak, isn't there? RTFM? I won't say, I'll keep it polite, read the flipping manual is, you know, what that stands for. And you kind of find that that's a fairly common occurrence on internet stuff. But Kickstarter, excuse me, one of my cats is just delving into a bag. She shouldn't delve in. Poopy, thank you, mate. sorry, viewers.
No, that's extra content. I know exactly what you're saying, though. I belong to quite a few podcasting groups on Facebook. And the number one thing that gets posted on each of them, and these are groups that predominantly have the really big names in podcasting, people who make their living from it, who are experts and pros. They have books in the top 10 bestsellers all over the world on the topic. Yeah. And so people go here because they know they can learn something from these individuals. And I got to say, the groups are very supportive and people help one another. And they have very stringent rules on things like self-promotion, for example, because then no one's ever going to come to the group if it's just a list of everyone saying, check out my latest podcast. But the number one thing that gets posted to these groups, and I'll see it one post, and then 20 minutes later, there'll be another post, and an hour later, another post, all from different people, is how can I record an audio episode on Skype and then record it on Windows every single time? And the answer is always, if you have Windows, you get Skype and use a program called Pamela. And if you're on Mac, you use Call Recorder.
Yeah.
That's the answer. And even if they just scrolled up, click on the group and scroll up, you know, three posts, they would see the same question and someone would politely answer. And there's that little search bar in Facebook that you go. And so I try to be polite whenever I see this, and I want to help people because I feel it's in my nature. Yeah. But at the same time, I feel a little snarky because I got to fight that, because it's not very polite or nice of me to be snarky with anyone, because I'm sure I've done it before. And I can do it again. And, you know, we're all human. We all make mistakes. So I've resorted to saying, posing a question in response. And I'll say, there used to be this little search bar feature here on Facebook. Did they take it away or is it still there? Because it was very helpful for me. I could go in there and type in my question and see if anyone else had asked it and then get my answer. And I leave it at that. And I literally copy and paste. Each time I see it, I copy and paste. Yeah. And without fail, someone else, and I presume they're playing along, they'll say, well, yes, the search bar is just right up there. You just go and you click and you do so forth. And I use this elsewhere too. I use it in real life. Same question. I'll say, I'm not sure, but did someone else mention that? I can't recall. And I play it down, because if you're like, it's right here, you moron. That is mean, right? And I don't want to insult people, but at the same time, like you said, there's that collective groan. Someone just asked that. Just go. And I don't think it's that people are upset that these questions exist and that people aren't putting the effort in. I think it's that we're trying to hope and help other people to empower themselves so that they can put the effort in themselves and maybe get a response and an answer more quickly than if they waited on one of us. And yet at the same time, they will have that common foundation so then they can ask the more involved questions, whether it's about podcasting or wargaming or whatever, so that they can get the help that's harder to get. instead of this more common occurrence, who's Don Featherstone? Well, go to Wikipedia, type his name in, and you're going to find out.
Yeah.
Ask about one of his books. I can't find this particular book. Do you know where it is? Or he mentioned once such and such a thing. I don't remember the exact quote. And I'd like to take that and use it because it came up in a game. But something that's harder to get at.
Absolutely, yeah.
And for me anyway, I think that's where the collective groan comes from for me.
Yeah.
But maybe for some people, they're just like, that moron, how dare they ask such a thing? I don't know.
It's also one of those things about the internet. I mean, the internet's kind of fascinating because we've got used to it being kind of a medium of free exchange of information. You know, whereas in the old days, if you wanted to make use of someone's expertise, you're going to get charged for that expertise.
People might not know I work in a library. Of course, in the old days, and actually even now, depending on the type of library, if you want information that requires an actual librarian, someone with their graduate degree in library and information sciences to help you on something really specific, you have to pay in order to get the stuff that they want. Even though the library itself might be free, you might have very specific needs or archival needs, and then you have to pay to get access, to get for their time, for any materials that they let you borrow might have a cost, and copying of stuff is very, very expensive. You still have that free idea, and so much is freely available, but it doesn't mean that you should just be asking those. I was actually talking with a coworker the other day, and I say this as I was, my phone's lighting up because people are tweeting all sorts of stuff. And she was remarking that her husband, who's a doctor, gets very annoyed at their children because when they text or they talk through some sort of instant messaging program, and I think people do this in social media, which is why I'm mentioning it. I think they do it on Kickstarter, which I consider a type of social media, a weird one, but a type. If they have, say, a whole 3 or 4 statements to make, instead of writing a little brief paragraph of what their 3 or 4 statements are, they do one line, they press enter, they send it. 2 seconds later, the next one comes in. 2 seconds later, the next one. And I think they treat it like a conversation like this instead of writing a letter. And so my coworker remarked that her husband hates it because their kids do that. And his phone keeps on going, zzz, 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 zzz. It'll be... And so they don't just send the one long thing, and people do it on, I see it all the time on Kickstarter, on Facebook, on Twitter, everything. I'll just get all these update pages, the next thing, and then the thing after that. And it just, it's so ridiculous because people can't wait to just put all their thoughts out there and then put it up. And yet at the same time, I think it's kind of weird because even if people did put all of that stuff together, someone on the other end, they don't read it. There's that internet kind of meme, TLDR. It's too long, don't read.
Yeah.
And so they'll read it if it's 3 statements separated out, but if you put it together in a paragraph, they won't read it, and then they go and they email the Kickstarter creator. What does this mean? Where is this? Because I didn't want to read your paragraph, but if you only put it at his bullet points, maybe then I would.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting. I can remember a long time ago, back in the late 90s, when I was first designing websites, I was doing usability studies, and we discovered this. And this is where the trend started of, if you're doing stuff on the web, turn it all into bullet points, because people will read a set of bullet points, whereas they won't read an entire paragraph. Even if they're reading, at the end of the day, the same number of words, if you divide it into bullet points, they're more likely to actually read it. It's crazy. It's turning information into PowerPoint. And man, I don't like PowerPoint, but.
Well,
we're getting away from wargaming a bit there, Jonathan.
We were talking a little bit before about how Kickstarter or just success in general can kind of kill a company or kill a project. I just want to mention, one that it's done the opposite. It's helped it to grow even more. There's this company called Dwarven Forge, and their stuff gets used a little bit for wargaming. It's more for role-playing games, but it's fantastic, beautiful 3D terrain, hand-sculpted, and then mass-produced. And it's made by this incredible guy from New York City. Well, he lives there, called Stefan. And their last Kickstarter, they've done 3 so far.
Yeah.
Their last Kickstarter, raised over $2.25 million.
Oh my God.
They have over 2,700 backers. All the stuff is shipped that it's supposed to be. It was estimated for it to be delivered this week. People have been posting YouTube unboxing videos saying that they've received their stuff in good condition, like they wanted. People could pay extra to have it pre-painted. And the videos that they make for this and the stuff that they've done to promote it, it's absolutely gorgeous. It's a super small team, a super small company, and yet they've been able to do this. And some people, they get killed by it. There's been that news recently regarding Architects of War and All Quiet on the Martian Front, and how things have, I think we're still going to be learning stuff about that for who knows how long. And there's numerous, but then there's successes. And I was going to just briefly mention later on in the episode, but the head honcho of the Troll in the Corner podcast network, Ben Gerber, was on because he's a board game designer. Yeah. And he talked about a game of his called Swamped.
Mm-hmm.
It just arrived. And I love when, I don't back a lot of Kickstarter stuff because I'm honestly very wary about it. To me, it's like gambling. Yeah. Don't pledge anything you can't afford to lose. And as one who doesn't have a whole lot that I could afford to lose, I as such don't pledge much. But even knowing that Ben's game would be good and that if he says it's going to happen, it's going to come out, it's going to get made, I'm going to get it. It's still that satisfaction when it arrives and you get the package and you look. And especially so when you hear all this stuff about these things that aren't getting made, and it's not just, you know, Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Mainstream companies who aren't using Kickstarter have the same issues, but just being able to see someone have the success that they're hoping for and that they're aiming for, I think it's a nice thing for the community as a whole.
Of course it is. And also, you know, talking of Kickstarter, one of the biggest, well, I think one of the most exciting things that's going to be happening because of the success of Kickstarter is the movie. Miniature Wargaming, the movie, which I'm going to be in.
Yes, you are.
I don't think I'm going to be in it as much as I am in this podcast. I think I'm probably going to have a few 30-second slots, something like that. But that's been really nice because I was approached, oh, crikey, it's quite some time ago now, probably early last year, by Joseph Piddington, the guy who's kind of putting the project together. Asking me, you know, whether I would help, you know, give him some advice about who to talk to. So that was kind of really nice, just being asked in the first place. And he read my book and everything, so he had some background about the hobby in general. And just seeing the enthusiasm of this guy, and actually how little money he was asking for, because you kind of, oh, you know, making a full-length documentary movie and stuff, you kind of imagine that he would want huge amounts of money. But actually, I think he was only asking for something like £5,000. They needed to buy one new camera, and they needed some money to put towards the entrance fees of some film festivals so that the movie would actually get seen. So I kind of thought, man, you're not asking very much. Now, fortunately, it was one of those happy cases where the Kickstarter was oversubscribed. So they raised, I can't remember exactly how much, but plenty more than they needed. Let's put it like that way. So this thing's actually going to get made. And I think that's a really nice thing when you've got a truly creative project like that that's been funded by, if you like, the will of the people. Rather than him just going to the bank. Because also, you know, if you just went to the bank and said, oh, could we have a loan, please, for this? We want to make a movie about people who play with toy soldiers. The bank manager would probably say, not interested.
Go start off, I think is what they would probably say.
So, there we go. I've got a report, Johnson. You have turned into a little Wargaming Recon logo. I can't see your face anymore. Oh, there you are. You're back. Folks at home, don't get freaked out as much as I am by this. This is kind of weird.
Google Hangouts are a very odd animal, and yet they are, for me, the best way to be able to speak with people like you, Henry, so that everyone else can see live. And it integrates with, people don't care, but it integrates with YouTube. It makes it easier. And yet things like that happen.
Of course it is. And also, let's be honest, it's amazing because you're sitting somewhere. Where do you live, Jonathan? I can't remember. You're over in America somewhere.
I'm just outside of Boston, and, you know, I'm in my little, office here and my wife's with the baby and maybe the baby's taking a nap. I don't care.
Boston, 5 hours difference from where I'm here in southern UK in home. So it's pretty amazing, really.
And it costs us nothing to do this.
It costs us nothing. Folks, nothing is a good price to pay.
It is. But you know what? I am so excited for the miniature wargaming movie. It was great having Joseph on because he is so passionate about that and he's able to convey it in just his time with me. I was going to back it anyway, but just in his time with me, he convinced me that this not only would be great as a documentary, it should be a mini series. He should do like an hour, four episodes of an hour each mini series documentary, multi-part. I told him that and I mean, I know nothing about any of this, but maybe someday. And it's interesting too, because like you said, some of the money raised from it is going to be used for those entrance fees for film festivals because they're really expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had told him about one here in Boston that's very popular. A lot of individuals from some of the larger film festivals actually come here because it's cheaper and easier to get into. And I said, hey, you know, take some of the money, come here. He's going to be doing a U.S. tour and doing the film festivals. When if he gets up here, rather, I think we're going to try to make plans to meet in person and just kind of talk about the movie. And do you know what? The movie is going to be shorter than this episode here. So, but much higher production quality.
I think that's fair to say. They're also going to be cramming more into it, I think, in it. Yeah. Never mind. You mentioned earlier before we came on that there might be some people asking questions.
Yes.
Have any questions through?
Well, as listeners, long-time listeners especially know, one of my favorite sections of the show, not that I don't love talking with you, Henry, but one of my favorite sections is the mailbag section where I get to just kind of read some of the listener feedback and comments that have come in. My favorite part of podcasting is actually communicating with people who listen to the show because it's a great community of wargamers out there, people who are actually wargaming or interested in it, and just getting to know everyone it's so wonderful because we're all over the place. We're all so different and yet we have this common thread that allows us to push any differences aside and just kind of get to know each other as people and like each other. It's beautiful. Yeah. So mailbag is, as I said, one of my favorite sections of the show. And I actually have, I've got a few things here. Two of them are questions, which I'll hold off on the moment. But one is actually a little bit from a blog, Jack Sarger's War Games Ramblings blogs, which I mentioned last time. I'll have a link in the show notes. But it's pertinent actually because his comment deals with the miniature wargaming movie Kickstarter. He said of episode 148, and that's when Joe Piddington came on, quote, after listening to an interview with movie maker Joseph Piddington, I decided to back this excellent project for a hard copy of the DVD, unquote. And I know he did a whole blog post on there and other people responded and said that they too were backing the movie because of that. And I think this just goes to show the power of word of mouth.
Absolutely.
And this is, I gotta say, this is a great blog to look at. I'm not one who spends a lot of time reading blogs just because I don't have the time, really. I work. I help take care of the baby. I go to sleep. That's my life.
Yeah.
But very interesting to see. And I mentioned this on the previous episode because he had listed Wargaming Recon as one of the best podcasts to listen to while painting. He put us up there with Meeples and Miniatures, which I take as a huge compliment to us because Neil's done amazing things. And I always consider Neil like he is the trendsetter when it comes to this. So any sort of comparison is just puts a smile on my face.
Awesome, but, yeah.
Then also from Facebook, we got a couple comments, questions really from listeners. So listener Dave would like to know, Henry, if you could say which miniature painter or painters you admire and aspire to emulate.
Oh my goodness, crikey. Okay, well, I was brought up in a generation where miniatures were painted much more simply until Peter Gilder was the famous guy in the 1970s through to 1980s, whose armies featured on, funnily enough, the cover of the original Miniature War Games when it first came out. and inside, because all his figures were used at the War Games Holiday Center in Scarborough back in those days. And for a long time, like many people, I aspired to be able to paint figures like Peter Gilder. Those were, oh, cracky, back in those days, they would have been 25 millimeter scale Hinchliffe miniatures. Since then, well, paintings mushroomed because individual painters are kind of, there's the number of people whose painting has been admired because of the internet has absolutely mushroomed. And to pick one person out would be kind of difficult, really. There's lots of people I've admired. I mean, over the years, Phil Ollie, Barry Hilton, recently I was looking at a blog, or Facebook page, David Imrie, who does a lot of kind of 17th century stuff. Obviously, well, Kevin Dallimore. Kevin Dallimore's got a very specific kind of style that he, it's one of those questions, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Because there was the Foundry three-color paint system was developed to match his painting style because that was the way he kind of painted in the first place. Where, you know, you got a base coat of highlight and then a second highlight. And when you look at them close up, often they're quite impressionistic. Oh, there are just so many people.
Maybe it's easier for you to say a type of style you like to use or a certain method you tend to prefer.
It depends as well what you're painting for, because there's the wargaming style, which can be quite basic, but seen at 3 foot distance is very effective. It also depends on what scale of miniature you're painting. Because for example, there's a guy, he's going to have to forgive me because I've forgotten his surname. But it's Mike, Dr. Mike, who paints the 6mm miniatures for Bacchus. You know, tiny 6mm miniatures. And he does a phenomenal job with them. I've seen him painting them live at the Joyous Six show that Bacchus run each year, up in Sheffield. And what he achieves with 6mm miniatures is astonishing. But obviously that's a style suited to tiny miniatures rather than to 28mm miniatures. There are other people, names I forget now, who've painted like kind of 54mm model style, size and bigger, who achieve the most phenomenally realistic results. But unless you're utterly mad, you're never going to do that kind of thing on War Games miniatures. Although it has to be said, some of the fantasy miniatures, I mean, there's that site, isn't there, Cool Mini or Not, where some of the painting that you see, you know, non-metallic metals and that kind of stuff going on, you know, 28mm fantasy miniatures is astounding. There's no other word for it. They are phenomenal works of art in their own right. There are too many good painters, to be honest, to mention. There's a lot of the, you know, the people who provide painting services, you know, just pick up any copy of the magazine, you can see their names in there. I'm thinking of, for example, there's a guy who runs a company called Shakespeare Studios, Jez Griffin, who's painted some stuff for me in the past, he did some pirates for me quite some time ago now, God, long time ago, and some Mexican kind of ranchero types. His ability is just amazing. There's Jed Cronin, who is more famous nowadays for Gringo 40s, the miniatures company. But he ran a company, I think it was called GJM Figurines. He ran that for years. And he's painted a few figures for me, and he's an incredibly talented guy as well. So much, when it comes to miniatures painting, I think there's a number of things to address. The first thing is, what's your own ability? That's the first thing, right? I can remember us, you and I, having a conversation about painting miniatures, Jonathan, along these lines, and you remembering your first stumbling efforts at painting your American War of Independence miniatures. And that's when you first got in contact with me, because you weren't sure, you know, these miniatures, how the hell are you supposed to paint them, Henry? You know, how are you supposed to organize them? What do you do with them? So, but the first thing is, okay, what's your own ability? How much time have you got? That is the other thing. A major, major factor for most people these days is, you know, you might aspire to paint museum quality miniatures, but if you can only afford, you know, 15 minutes a day on your painting and you've got a Napoleonic army to paint, I think you better change your approach, right? This is one of the things that I'm going through, is because I love beautifully detailed miniatures. You know, I love lavishing time and attention on them, but I'm looking at, okay, I'm 55 years old this year, right? Okay. How long might I live? How many hours a day do I have to spare? Now I'm running Miniature War Games magazine. Not very many hours a day to spare. Plus I've got to eat, sleep, you know, spend some time with my good lady and do other things with my life, for goodness sake, like write books. So how much time per day can I realistically afford? Probably on average half an hour, really. I used to think, oh yes, I could sit down for an hour a day, but there are other things I've now got to say, oh gosh, are more important that I have to, you know, prioritize. So painting miniatures on average, say 30 minutes a day. Even, that's more likely, in fact, to be broken up into, say, two or three or four slightly longer sessions during the week rather than actually 30 minutes a day. And then other things come into play, you know, well, who's going to see these miniatures? I think people have got paranoid because there are magazines like mine that have big photographs like this on the cover and inside where, you know, I've got the macro lens out and I've zoomed right in close on a miniature so you can literally see the pimples kind of thing. And people have got paranoid about painting to a standard where it looks perfect even under a magnifying glass. And this is crazy because 99.9% of the time, that's not how we're looking at these miniatures. We are playing with them on a table and they're kind of arm's length. What a tip someone gave me a long time ago was, look, when it comes to the mass of your troops, you can paint, you can get away with painting them to a fairly basic standard. It's the command stands, you know, the guy who's holding the colors and the officer and the drummer and the fifer. That's the stand that's more likely to catch people's eye. And so if they lean over and go, oh, that looks nice, and kind of even sometimes unbidden will pick it up and look at it closely, it tends to be the prettiest stand. So if you're going to spend a bit of extra time to get the eyes right or whatever it is, do that on the command stand. Don't spend so much time on the rest of the unit. So that, I think, is good advice. So to, you know, make your units seem that they're painted to a higher quality than actually most of them are. But as to an individual, you know, favorite painter, I'll be honest, I couldn't say, because most of them, you know, I take my hat off to them, that the standard to which some of these guys can paint miniatures is phenomenal. But, you know, and there may come a time as well where I have to look at, gosh, you know, my time for painting is even less than I thought. I need to start farming stuff out. And let's be honest, there are these guys out in, you know, Sri Lanka and other places, people like Fernanda Enterprises, who actually do a pretty amazing job for not very much money. And, you know, I think we might have talked about this on a previous podcast. I went through kind of a bit of a crisis of conscience about, oh gosh, you know, are we effectively as war gamers using slave labor, you know, paying peanuts to these people who are doing, you know, painting beautiful model soldiers to beautiful standard? Are we exploiting them? But having spoken to someone who actually is involved with one of these companies, he points out actually in these countries, these are some of the highest paid people in their local communities. You know, what we pay them to paint model soldiers is actually enabling them to look after their families and that kind of stuff, which is like, well, okay. And, you know, as I say, I've seen, you know, there's some quite big names in wargaming who I shan't mention, who may be wanting to keep a secret that they used some of these, you know, mass painting companies. But they very proudly display the figures, you know, quite a lot of them on some quite lavish terrain, and they look great. So, you know, horses for courses. That's kind of the expression I'm looking for.
I think for myself, of course, I am not a painter by any stretch of the imagination. I get two examples here. They are Flames of War objective markers. This is one I painted a long time ago. It's a fuel dump. I spent 12 hours on it, between, you know, blending paint and getting the right hue and inking and drying and all that kind of stuff. This is one I did as part of the Extra Life 24-hour Gamerthon fundraiser. It took me 45 minutes to an hour. There's no major discernible difference as far as I can tell. The 12-hour one, I'm actually ashamed of because it took me 12 hours. That's 12 hours of my life. I mean, not in one go, but you know, you do some 12 hours of my, that is enough time to sleep. I could go to work. I could do all these things, spend all that time with my family, with friends, and 12 hours for that, or 45 minutes to an hour for the other one. And they're both perfectly fine for the table. And are they going to win awards? No. Are they meant to? No. If I can do that in 45 minutes to an hour, and yes, it's an objective marker, very simple to do. I don't need to worry about painting eyes or getting, the right color, facings or any of that kind of stuff on a uniform. But even so, if I can do that and it to me looks just as fine as one I spent 12 hours on, then I think you're right. We are killing ourselves over this because, for a lot of my friends, they'll look at, say, and I'm not trying to pick on your publication, but Miniature War Games, and they'll look and they will be inspired by the models that they see there and how beautiful they look and the terrain and everything. And when I look at that, I appreciate the effort and the skill that goes in, but it depresses me because I know I can't or won't be able to get to that. So things like that on some level actually make me think, you know, why bother painting? Because I will never be able to get that. And is that true? No. I mean, if I put the time, I could someday be as good. But I'm not going to, for a variety of reasons, partly can't, partly won't. And then also that mental hangback is, am I ever going to be good enough to be in a magazine? And it doesn't matter because that's not what I want. But that little nagging thought makes me think, why bother? Don't. And I know I'm not alone, but it's funny. Some people see it and they say, I want to be as good as, and other people like myself say, oh, I can never do that.
But this is also why, and again, we might mention this in a previous chat, both with battle games and now with miniature war games, I've always made a conscious effort to show our widest. You're back now, Jonathan.
Yeah, Google's having issues today.
I don't know if you heard what I just said. This is why with Battle Games Magazine and with Miniature War Games, I've always made the conscious effort to show a wider spectrum of painting styles. That, you know, occasionally, and it is only occasion, we'll have literally kind of award-winning professional level kind of painting. But a lot of the time, it's the figures that people use for their games, and they're taking pictures of real games in progress. There was an article that Barry Hilton did in Battle Games Magazine, obviously several years ago now, in which he, I think it was, I know what it was. It was when Perry Miniatures had not long come out with their first box of American Civil War infantry. And Barry Hilton painted a load of Confederate infantry. There was like, oh crap, it might have been 8 or 10 different painting styles, ranging from virtually painting the eyelashes through to basically kind of basic colors and then dip. And the article was fascinating because at the end of it, he kind of said, do you know what? I'm so depressed because I've always been someone who's put the, you know, every buttonhole on and almost kind of engraved the buttons on, you know, on the jacket kind of thing. I'm so depressed because the, you know, figure number 8, where I basically went bish, bash, bosh, looks just as good as the one I spent about 3 hours per miniature painting. That, I think, taught a lot of people a great deal. And this is also around the period when dip started to become popular because people realized, you know what? You can just do a basic color for a jacket and the trousers and, you know, the equipment and whatever, and then, you know, put the thing on the end of a pair of pliers, dunk it in the pot, hold it there for a second, shake off the excess, leave it to dry, and it's going to look fantastic. You know, there are still a lot of purists who say, oh, no, no, I want to ruin my eyesight. This is part of the hobby for me is sending myself blind, you know, doing this. But the fact of the matter is, you know, you don't have to. And 99% of the time, no one's going to give a damn and no one can tell the difference. It's only, you really have to be someone who knows your onions, who will pick it up and, you know, really scrutinize it. But then they're the same sort of people who will go, I think you'll find.
Those are the kind of people I refuse to play games with because I don't get enjoyment.
Exactly. So they can think what they like about your miniatures. Anyway, back to your question.
Well, before we go there, I want to say one thing that actually has helped me to kind of deal with that little nagging thought whenever I look at Wargaming Magazine and I see those beautiful models. Because, I mean, like anyone else, I try to share what I do, share online, usually tie it into the show. I'll say, hey, I'm actually painting something, and I put it up online for people to see. It's actually a section of your book that has, it's probably the most helpful section and most used section for me from your book.
Oh,
and
cool.
It starts on page 447, Advice for the Digital Age, where you talk about photography for wargamers. And you have quite a few pages here on it, and just the tips that you give on really focusing on what you're doing, don't get too close, making sure you have the appropriate lighting, that even with my, you know, my iPhone 5S here,
yeah,
it's by no means a great camera. It's not like an SLR or whatever.
The camera in this
I can take pictures with this, and I can do things I never would have thought of before. As something simple like really making sure and being aggressive in my cropping of photos, and that makes a difference, and using an interesting angle. I have a cool thing that I use if I'm going to take photos with it, and I bring to conventions when I go. It's called a GorillaPod, or it's not the official one.
Yeah.
Fits the iPhone right in it. You put it in. You can hang this around a tree branch if you want it for nature photography, whatever. I go. It's a nice stable location for it, and then I have this really cool thing. I think it's made in Taiwan, but you can get them all over. It's a little Bluetooth syncing device. It's on a little keychain fob. It syncs with your iPhone, syncs with an Android phone, so that you put your phone there and you press the button and it takes photo, so you don't get the shakes with it. I have unstable hands, which is why my painting usually is not so great. But if I put the phone in there, I don't get shaky pictures anymore. Put it on the table. I press it. I can do video with it as well. But both of these were dirt cheap on Amazon, and just something that I do so that when I share photos of stuff that I've worked on or that I see, it makes my inferior attempts look maybe not so bad. Things I never would have thought of if I hadn't read in your book. I think they're very introductory level kind of stuff that, to me, a lot of it's probably common sense, but I never would have thought of it until I picked up your book and I read and said, hey, wait a sec. This is perfect sense, and if it works for Henry, I bet it's going to work for me too.
The thing is that that book's full of stuff where I, as I was writing it, I was thinking, God, am I teaching Granny to suck eggs here? Am I just stating the bleeding obvious constantly here for 500 pages? But the fact of the matter is, it's always surprising, you know, even when you're thinking that yourself, how many people haven't thought of these things? And so, you know, I'm just delighted, you know, if something that I put in the book about taking photographs has been helpful to you, that's brilliant. Very happy.
Well, and then the other question, and actually you seem to have become a still image, which is Google.
I can see that in my little window down here.
Playing around with us again. But the other question comes from another listener Jamie, who's from Norway. His question for you is, as a man on the inside of the historical gaming world, but the outside of the main businesses, why does it seem that only World War II gets decent starter sets?
Oh, now that's a good question. Because I think with World War II, it's easier to classify what a starter set needs to include. And also because, I mean, I would imagine you're thinking of something like Flames of War or, Bolt Action or, now, of course, there's the Plastic Soldier Company has just come out with its army boxes as well. It's kind of easier to predict what someone would want as a starter pack. You know, a platoon of infantry, a couple of troops of tanks, a couple of anti-tank guns, a little bit of scenery maybe, or always used to be the way. Whereas you start looking at any other period. Well, first of all, the other thing with World War II is it's more predictable what scale people are going to want to play with as well. So it's more, you know, 15 millimeter Flames of War, and Plastic Soldier Company, interestingly, its army boxes have come out in 15 millimeter scale. With the bolt action stuff, I can't remember, is it 28 mil, isn't it? Bolt action.
I think so, yeah.
This, I think, makes it, you know, fairly easy to predict what people are going to want and what armies people are going to want. You know, you're going to want Germans, Americans, Russians, British, probably late war British, something like that. Those are kind of the core ones. And even amongst the Germans, people might say, well, there's a Wehrmacht German and there's an SS German because so many people like the SS. Let's not talk too much about that, the psychology behind that. So it just makes it easier. Whereas if you're talking about, ancients, for example, just think of the range of armies there are. Now there's a caveat here because of course someone who has successfully done starter sets is Bacchus with its 6mm, Polymos rule starter set. And in fact I've got, should I confess that I bought some some starter sets from Peter Berry at Bacchus. Oh, it's amongst the unpainted lead something. Yeah, you know, Romans versus Gauls. That's a classic combination. He's also, what have I got from late Romans and Sassanid Persians, Greeks and Persians. You could probably do that. When you're talking about other periods, he's also done, you know, Napoleonic starter sets, you know, British and French or Russian and French or whatever. But in bigger scales, where you're giving away fewer units, I think it just seems to be more of a headache. It's also, I think with a lot of those starter sets that Pete Berry at Bacchus does, they're tied in with the Polymos rule set. Whereas in other, you know, you probably could do it. But many people just don't seem to have done it. Because, for example, you could say, right, there's a black powder starter set. Now, having said this, haven't Warlord just done a black powder starter set for the American War of Independence?
I think so. And do you know what? It's not a two army starter, but they've done it for, Hail Caesar as well, I think. They have what and they call starter armies for like Imperial Rome, Republican Rome, Carthaginians and so forth.
And Perry Miniatures have just done their Battle in a Box, for the American Civil War, with their own little rule set in there and so on and so forth. So it can be done. Why other people haven't done it, I don't quite know. It's partly, I think, to do with when it comes to metal miniatures. Many of the companies making metal miniatures. Wow, that is a tongue twister, isn't it? Many of the manufacturers making metal miniatures are comparatively small companies, in fact, and often are kind of one man band or family outfits. Where they're just concentrating on trying to get the product out the door. And many of them, I know from experience, don't have, much marketing nous. You know, because it's always one of those things that's dawned on me is that, you know, if I was setting up a miniatures company at all, starter sets would be one of the things I would want to do kind of almost straight away. Because it makes sense to me. Say, if someone wants to take up Napoleonic wargaming in, think of a scale, 28 millimeter, then they're gonna need, you know, French. Everyone fights the French, don't they? In the Napoleonic Wars. Versus, you know, Russians, Austrians, British, etc., etc., etc. And you would have thought by now, where are we, year 2016, more people would have come out with starter sets of that kind. That they haven't done yet is interesting. Why? Because I suppose people then have to think in terms of, well, if I'm going to do that, do I need to produce my own rule set to go along with those figures so that it then makes sense. So you've got, say, say you buy a British and French Peninsular War starter set. What are you going to need in there? You're probably going to need, to make any sense, you know, have a game of any kind of decent size, you're going to want, I know, two or three battalions of infantry aside, regiment of cavalry aside, a battery of artillery aside, you know, start adding up how many figures that will come to, plus a rule set that makes sense of them. So, you know, well, say you were playing my Shot, Steel and Stone rules, you can actually play those in two versions. You could do what I call the old school version where you get lots of figures. So, you know, it might be 36 or 48 figures per battalion, but you could play at half that size. So say 18 or 24 figures per battalion. And then you've got your regiment / large squadron of cavalry. So maybe a dozen figures, something like that, and a battery of artillery times two plus the rule set. Then some scenery. What kind of scenery would you put in? Some hedges, maybe some walls, some fences, a couple of trees, this and that. It's tricky. It would have to be in some sort of kit form or flat form. Then you start looking at, well, how much is this box actually costing me? And it's quite a big ticket item quite often. Someone's going to have to forgive me because there's the Spanish company whose name has completely escaped me, who had started doing just this kind of thing in 15mm. And so they were doing, is it Revolutionary War and early Napoleonic War stuff? I'm not sure how far they'd got. I'm not kind of been following it. And I don't know how well they've been doing with that. But I can imagine that that's the main reason. You know, when you say, why aren't more people doing it? Well, the big plastics manufacturers are starting to do it. The smaller companies beyond that, I think it's just beyond their means in terms of project management. And in terms of tying in what they're producing with, you know, making a judgment call about what a popular rule set is that people would want to play. I think they just think it's easier to say, look, you go off and choose the set of rules that you want. You choose the scale of figures that you want and hey, we'll sell you the figures. And then there's this other guy over there who'll sell you the scenery. I think there just hasn't been the incentive. This, of course, is about to change radically because, as we've just featured in the latest issue of the magazine, Airfix are coming out with their new game, Airfix Battles, which of course, even though initially what they're doing is kind of a flat card based thing, it's obviously going to, if they've got any brains at all, it's going to start tying in with their boxes of 1/72 scale plastic figures. And I think it's not going to be too long in the future that you probably will be able to buy kind of an Airfix Battles World War II, obviously initially, game in a box, which will include the rules, will include some flat card scenery, and will include a number of sprues of kind of infantry and tanks and that kind of stuff. But other than that, your friend there is just going to have to write to the manufacturers who you'd like to see do box sets and say, why aren't you doing this? Because we don't know.
I actually think that maybe, and it's probably not anywhere near the most important or top reasons why they don't do it. But I think maybe one of the reasons why is they don't want to deal with the inevitable backlash of people being dissatisfied with what was chosen for sure. The sets. I've seen it, you know, with the big companies, with Games Workshop, with Private Press. When you look at Sci-Fi Gaming and Fantasy Gaming, when they have their starter games, Battle of Skull Pass and so forth, and people pick it up and they're paying 70, 80 bucks for this starter set that has a miniaturized version of the rules and some sort of starter army for stuff, and people get dissatisfied with what's chosen because they find out after they get into it, the things in the box maybe aren't really that useful or they're not that common. They're not things you're going to use in an average game. And if it's like that for, you know, this fantasy realm, whether you're playing 40K or you're playing Warhammer Fantasy or you're playing Warmer Hordes or any of those other non-historical stuff, just imagine some curmudgeon coming out and saying, well, you know, you're doing ancients here, and you pitted the Sassanids, and you pitted them against the ancient Celts, and why did you do that? And what made you think to put, and then really specific unit types and the sculpting and so forth and posing. And they get that nowadays with just the regular boxes, but then having it set up like this, I wonder if maybe the better route to go is kind of like what Warlord has done, where they're doing a focus on the army or battalion sets, yeah, where it's one specific faction or nation. And
the same with Plastic Soldier, of course, as I just mentioned, you know, though you're buying a particular nationality stuff, and yep, you know exactly what's going to be in the box. And it represents, also, that way, it represents quite a hefty discount.
It does. So you, even if you're paying, say, like $80 for it, you're getting, depending on skill, you're getting a lot of stuff. You're getting things that are going to be usable. And if you are, I know a lot of historical wargamers like to have two armies for whatever period or skill they're doing, so that it's easier to find someone to play against. They can then pick up the other one, or they can say to a gaming buddy, well, I'm going to collect this. I will work on this. I'm getting these things. Here they are. Click the link. You can see. How about you get these? For us, this makes sense for what we want to do. And in an unofficial kind of way, it's something I've done with a buddy of mine, Adrian, for Hail Caesar, which is a very, very long project. We will take years probably to get. You will be done with your ancient wargaming rules by the time we're probably ready to do it. But we divided it out. We wanted to do 1/72nd scale, Caesar miniatures, hat industry. And we looked in the hopes that they would have either some sort of starter sets or army boxes, battalion sets or whatever. Mm. And unfortunately, they didn't. And for those of you who watch live recordings of the show, you can see over my left shoulder as I point somewhere over there, which... I'm not good, but I mean, there is a hat industry box right there, and this is how it worked out. Like, instead of me buying both or my buddy buying both armies, we were like, we're doing this and this, and of course, it cost more because it's separate. Oh, we had to buy individual boxes, and it didn't just cost more for us; it cost more for the manufacturer because they have to have all the packaging, you know, exponentially. How many boxes do they have to make? Whereas if they just did one larger box, they put it in, there's less extra stuff, the less boxes, less printing costs and so forth. And so I think the savings all around can translate into added profits for the company, which helps them stay around and get more staff and do good things, and also to the consumer. So I am understanding, but also kind of surprised that they haven't found a better way to approach the topic. But I mean, they've been doing this for years.
Yeah, but I could say a lot of them, with the big companies is fair point, but with the little companies, I mean, it's just a guy in a shed. You know, literally, quite often, it's just a guy in a shed. Give him a break. Give him a break.
No, I mean, you're right. I like Old Glory, for example, for 10 mil, 6 mil, 15 mil stuff. It takes them a long time to process an order, or what I consider a long time. But it's like, it's four people. It's a family. And they're open like half days, 3 days a week or something like that, that they work on, and they're casting their own stuff and doing everything. And, the things are very reasonably priced. They have a nice range. And, but it's like, it's three people who are working part time doing it. They probably have real jobs outside of it because no one can do any of this for a real job for whatever reason, because I don't know, people, the money's not there or whatever, but so that cuts back into it more. And you're right. Yeah. It's hard, for people to be understanding of things, but, it's an interesting situation to be in.
Sure.
So that was from listener Jamie, and that's mailbag for this episode.
Cool.
I actually have, and this doesn't, impact you, Henry, although one of these days, it might, because I would love to get you somehow across the pond to be a special guest at a tabletop gaming convention here somewhere.
I'd love to as well, Jonathan.
In the back of my mind, I've been thinking of like, what would the best fit be, and how can I try to nudge the organizers to go that way? But I actually have a giveaway that I'm going to be doing now for a local gaming convention. It's for Total Confusion. They are New England's largest tabletop gaming convention. This is their 30th year. They do role-playing games, old-school role-playing games, war games, miniatures, board games. They do all sorts of stuff. It's a fantastic group of people, and they've donated to the show a great thing. Someone will be able to win a free weekend pass to TotalCon. It gets you in the door for the whole weekend and you get in and you can play all sorts of cool stuff. The way this is going to work is the giveaway ends midnight Eastern Standard Time on Friday, February 12th. All you got to do, it's really, really simple, is you have to rate and review Wargaming Recon on iTunes. It doesn't have to be a long review. If you don't like the show and you're still listening, I don't know why, but if you don't like the show, say that, leave an honest review. If you love the show, say that too. I'm not asking for people to lie. Be honest in how you feel, but leave a rating. It's 1 to 5 stars. Leave a review. I'll have a link in the show notes, but it's wargamingrecon.com/iTunes. Will take you right there. You leave your rating and review, and then one person who does this at random will be chosen to get their free pass. I will announce the winner on our Facebook page, wargamingrecon.com/Facebook, and then I will either mail the pass to you if you're the winner, or you can pick it up in person at TotalCon. Like I said, it gets you into the con for free. TotalCon does something that other conventions do, but not all of them, where you pay in order to get into the convention, and then any of the events you want to attend or games you want to do, you buy event tickets for. So those are separate from this, but this saves you like, I think it's like 30 or 45 bucks, is what it does. And a cool thing, no matter whether or not you are the person who wins this cool free weekend pass, as long as you enter the contest at a future episode of the show, I will be reading all of the reviews that are left. So you will get your name mentioned or your iTunes moniker, your nom de plume, and what you say. I will read your review, so you'll be heard on the show in a future episode, and you have a good chance, depending on how many people enter, of getting this free weekend pass. And Henry, I think TotalCon would be an interesting convention for you because they're not strictly historical games, nor are they strictly war games. They have a selection of that, and a lot of attendees who come to it are historical war gamers here in New England, right. And they come here because they like to play other things. But TotalCon also has some really cool industry guests who I think you would be intrigued by. There are two individuals who come who used to work with Gary Gygax back when Dungeons & Dragons was founded. And one of them was the first editor of Dragon Magazine, and the other individual is one of, if not the first employee hired by TSR, and they did all those great historical military simulations way back and chainmail. So I think it would be kind of a neat other experience for you someday as someone sure. coming, but also to talk about stuff. And I would easily... Sure.
Coming to America at all would be a fabulous thing.
I don't know if it's ever in the cards, but I will put bugs in anyone's ear. And I mean, there are other conventions that I go to. Huzzah up in Maine. I know the folks up there have been very kind recipients of your generosity in the past for things for their raffles and so forth. But that would be a perfect fit for you too. And
I mean, well, obviously the big one that people want me to come to is
Historicon. Yeah.
So it'll happen sometime. And we actually do have some relatives over in the States, in way out in Wyoming.
Oh, I got family out there.
Elk Mountain, Wyoming.
It's beautiful country out there, but not enough people for my liking.
Yeah. It's kind of empty.
I heard a rumor /joke that there's like more moose in Wyoming than there are people. And I don't know if that's true.
Oh, I can believe that.
That's a little weird for me, but. Anyway, that's a TotalCon giveaway. I get to thank the kind people at Total Confusion for their kind donation of the passes. And not next episode, but the one after will be the one where I get to share my experience there, because I will be there doing all sorts of cool stuff. But
am I still a still image for you, Jonathan?
You are. I mean, it's a nice image. Don't get me wrong, but you're just very still in it, kind of like Madame Tussauds.
How very strange is that, because I can see I've got this little kind of window where I can see what my camera's seeing, and I haven't moved. I've been waving my arms around like crazy. I've done a dance here, you know, no see, one's noticed.
We're missing all the good stuff. People are stuck looking at my ugly face. I guess that's how it goes.
There we go. So it ended up being an audio recording after all.
Yeah, but do you know what? I think people enjoy the live aspect. Because they can say, hey, like, I was there when it happened. But people like the show because they listen to it when they're painting, when they're at work or commuting, and who has time to watch an hour anything online anymore?
Well, yeah, there you go.
But, yeah. So what else is going on, Henry? Any other cool things you want to chat about?
Oh, any other cool things, crikey. At the moment, Jonathan, what I'm mostly doing is working. I'm halfway through producing the next issue of the magazine, which goes to press this time next week. Upcoming events, obviously, 5th of March, we've got a show over here called Hammerhead, which is organized by the lovely Sally and Paul who run Callistra Miniatures. You may want to know about Callistra. Callistra are famous for their hexagonal terrain, the Hexon terrain that lots of people have been using recently. And which is great. For example, if you are a Commands and Colors player, Commands and Colors Ancients or Commands and Colors Napoleonics, but you like to play with miniatures, then just use the Callistra Hexon terrain and stick your miniatures on top and you can play using the Commands and Colors rules, which I and my friend Will Townsend do quite a lot. So that's up in Newark near Nottingham on the 5th of March, and I shall be there. Not only flying the flag for the magazine, but also actually putting on a little participation game. The Beebersfoot Annual All-Comers Waxball Tournament, which is basically a completely silly 18th century sort of paintball equivalent game, where players just get to use like half a dozen miniatures per team, and they go around shooting each other, but it's completely non-fatal, and everyone comes away with their honour intact. Totally stupid, but hopefully some people have some fun during the day. And in between running the games, I should be running around with my camera taking as many pictures as possible. And then, the following month in April, of course, is the big show over here for us, which is Salute, which is in the middle of April. I'm swinging around to look at my wall calendar. It's the 16th of April, Saturday the 16th of April this year, Salute in London's Docklands, organised by the South London Warlords, including John Treadaway, who writes a column for the magazine. And that's always, man, that's a vast day, because they get something like 6,000 people through the door into this huge hangar, and it's just, well, nowadays it's just like a mad shopping trip for a lot of people, I think. Because you get all the manufacturers there, historical, fantasy, sci-fi, even some board games as well, terrain manufacturers, KR multi-case, you do the sponge cases for carrying your miniatures around and that kind of stuff. And everyone just kind of throwing their money at the traders. Cause this is the nature of the hobby nowadays, cause there's no high street shops anymore. Even Games Workshop shops here in the UK, many of them have been reduced to just being staffed by one person. And obviously one person can't work 7 days a week, so they're only open like 5 or 6 days a week. So, and there's, hobby shops of any kind are getting much harder to find. So shows like Salute really do become, what we would call a supermarket, you would call a shopping mall. Where people have kind of seen the pictures on the website, but this is one of the few chances they actually get to kind of pick things up and poke them and see how they weigh, and then hand over some cash. So, I mean, I know people who spend well over £1,000 in a day at Salute, right?
Wow.
What's that going to be, like $1,400, something like that, in a single day? But hey, their money, they can do what they like with it. For me, the day is mainly, talking to people. It's a day when Salute, I can't remember the last time at Salute where I actually got to see all the games that are on display or talk to all the traders, because I can't get around. I mean, it's a lovely problem, but people keep, every 5 yards or so, someone will stop me and say, oh, hi, are you Henry Hyde? And that's lovely, I've got no complaint about that at all. By the end of the day, I will have lost my voice and I will have shaken hands with, 200 or 300 people. And somewhere in the distance, I will have noticed that there's some traders selling a lot of stuff and, some games going on. And it's always after the show when people go back and they post on their blogs what they saw at the show during the day. I go, man, where is that game? That game looked amazing. I never saw it. Where was that hiding? So that's the big thing in April. So that's kind of what I'm building up to. And also, you know, what am I doing? I'm trying to get two books written, Jonathan, amongst other things, and paint stupid numbers of miniatures that I've now invested in. All those English Civil War figures from Pendragon on top of what I already had there, American Civil War figures. I've got loads of 6mm figures from Backers. You saw on Twitter I was painting all my GHQ early war Germans. That was fun. That was good fun, you know. Something I would recommend, you know, a good way to keep you honest in your painting project is to, at regular intervals, show people, right, okay, this is what I've actually painted today. I promised I was going to get this painted. Did I fail or did I succeed? That was good fun, and I got loads of feedback from doing that. And in the end, the figures, the GHQ World War II figures, looked terrific. I was really pleased with those, which goes back to what we were saying about painting earlier, you know, realizing that even though those GHQ figures have got masses of detail on them, I mean, for one 285th scale, incredible amount of detail on them, at the end of the day, there's only so much you can actually see to paint, even with magnifying goggles on, right? So that was a really good project for me to do, because it kind of unlocked a sort of painting block that I had. So I've got lots of painting to do, lots of writing to do. What can I say? I probably ought to sleep at some point. But hey, there you are. Anyway, and also, I think it's probably time for us to wrap up here, Jonathan. We've been yakking for a couple of hours.
It goes by fast, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, Jess?
Oh, I gotta say, it's always a pleasure having you on here, Henry. It's entertaining, informative, it's a blast, and it's something I look forward to all year long. We don't do it often enough.
Hey, but you know, it's your viewers / listeners will also probably be aware that I just recorded a podcast with Neil Shuck, which we haven't done for a long time. And I, you know, I don't know where the time goes. Part of the process of getting older, having busier, more complicated life. I mean, you've got a child now as well, haven't you? With you, it just used to be bunny rabbits. And now you've got an actual child that you've got to pay attention to.
It takes more time than one would imagine, and yet it teaches you to be inventive with your time and how you spend it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's been a pleasure, Jonathan. It's been really good to catch up.
Well, thank you, Henry. And before we go, I want to just remind everyone that none of this would be possible without the sponsor for the show, the kind people over at the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They put on Huzzah, which is one of my favorite historical wargaming conventions. It takes place in Portland, May 13th through the 16th. I'm going to be there. I'll be doing a live recording of the show in person. So you can come, you can watch and see what happens there. And then also, the show wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the kind generosity of my backers on Patreon. Henry, you and I have talked a lot about crowdfunding and crowdsourcing and things like Kickstarter and so forth. Patreon's how I get some crowdfunding to keep the show going. So I want to thank Dave and the War Games at Battleshades Facebook group, Patrick and Chris P for their very kind support of the show. And you too can also support the show on Patreon for as little as $1 American per month. And that gets you in as a backer. You get access to see and listen to episodes before anyone else. Backers get those first, and you get behind the scenes content that's exclusive to Patreon. And there are other levels where you can get cool physical rewards, like we have special Wargaming Recon branded tape measures, and we got t-shirts, and you can get really cool personalized postcards that I mail every month. Each one is different and unique to the recipient, just kind of cool little things that I do. Or you can also have a level chosen like Dave and Patrick and Chris, where I thank you by name and express my gratitude to you in every episode in which you are a backer. It may not seem like much, you know, $1 an episode or some of the levels at like $7, I mean, a month rather, not per episode. May not seem like a lot, but when you add that up over the course of time, it makes a huge difference for the show. Like we were saying, I got a baby and money goes different places now. I'm not buying as many figures as I once did. But podcasting still, it adds up and going to these conventions and so forth. So every little bit that comes in makes a difference. It's much appreciated. And hopefully backers feel that they are getting a lot of value for what they are contributing. I also just want to remind everyone that the next episode of the show will be coming out on February 15th, the day after Valentine's, where we get a very special guest, Mike Payne. And Henry, you might be interested in him because he does pulp wargaming, but he's done his own kind of world. I guess you and I would call it like an imagination based off of Shanghai. He calls it Hankai, Little Trouble in Hankai. He does all this sort of really inventive gaming with it, but it's all geared towards children and adults who can play nicely with kids.
Oh, cool. So
he runs these games at game days, as participation events, at club events, and also at gaming conventions throughout New England. And they're very well attended. His tables are like, I think, 18 feet long, usually 4 feet wide, gigantic scratch-built terrain and ships all done by himself, 28-millimeter models. Everything is gorgeous. He paints it all himself. It's beautiful. And it's a very open world where you can attempt to do anything you want in his world of Hankai. You may not always be successful, but you can attempt. And it's a very simple dynamic where you use D10s and playing cards that he flips over and determines probabilities and all sorts of other stuff. And it's, no two games are the same, but it's so much fun. He is a game master that I say, no matter what he's running, I will always sign up for his games just because they are truly amazing. And I think we need to get more kids into tabletop gaming and make it more accessible to them. So he will be next time on the show talking about just all of that cool stuff. So it should be really cool to see what he does in that other niche area of tabletop board gaming.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you again, Henry, for being on. This has been a blast. And it's a long episode, and I know you have so much on your plate. So I appreciate you taking the time to be with us here for this episode of Wargaming Recon.
No problem. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I'm sure everyone has enjoyed your time with us, and I just want to remind everyone that no matter how busy you are in your lives, no matter how much playtesting you're doing for Shot Still in Stone, that you always know that you have to, you gotta, you need to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Are you a wargamer and want to know what to do when you're an Australian wargamer? Then you need to tune in to the Hobby Desk for Australian wargamers. This is a member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network, and we're here to give you the best possible things that Australian wargamers can give to you, the listeners. And I hope you enjoy what we do, because guess what? It's coming more and more often and more awesome for you who listen to the Hobby Desk on the Troll in the Corner podcast network.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network.
Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.
Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 13th to the 15th, 2016 at the Doubletree Inn in Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming in New England at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.